So how many of you are familiar with the Magiya Sutta? Many of you have never heard of the Magiya Sutta. Okay, so I've got a wide range. So the Magiya Sutta is from the Pali Canon, which is the earliest Buddhist scriptures that were written down after the oral tradition. It's from a part of the Pali Canon known as the Udana, which is said to be one of the oldest or earliest parts of the Pali Canon. Magiya was the Buddha's companion. Often the Buddha had one person that he had as a companion, like a secretary, personal assistant, all the rest of it. Magiya was the Buddha's companion at one time. Ananda, whom many of you will have heard of, was the Buddha's companion for the last 25 or 30 years of his life. The Buddha lived to be about 80, so he was probably in his 40s or something when Magiya was his companion. And the events of this sutta happened at a place called Chalika. It says on Chalika Hill. So I'll just read you the first part, the opening part of the sutta. It starts, "Thus have I heard," as I think all Pali Canon suttas start, "Thus have I heard," because it's Ananda who's relating the sutta, and he's saying, "This is what I've heard." "At one time, the Lord was staying at Chalika on Chalika Hill. At that time, the Venerable Magiya was the Lord's attendant. Then the Venerable Magiya approached the Lord, prostrated himself, stood to one side and said, 'I wish to go into Jantu village for alms food, revered sir. Do now, Magiya, what you think it is time to do.' Then the Venerable Magiya, having put on his robe in the forenoon and taken his bowl and outer cloak, entered Jantu village for alms food. Having walked in Jantu village for alms food, after the meal, on returning from collecting alms food, he approached the bank of the river Kimikala. As he was walking and wandering up and down beside the river for exercise, he saw a pleasant and charming mango grove. On seeing it, he thought, 'This mango grove is very pleasant and charming. It is eminently suitable for the endeavor in meditation of a young man of good family who is intent on the endeavor. If the Lord were to give me permission, I would come and endeavor in this mango grove.' Then the Venerable Magiya approached the Lord, prostrated himself, sat down to one side and said, 'Revered sir, having put on my robe in the forenoon, I approached the bank of the river Kimikala and saw a pleasant and charming mango grove. On seeing it, I thought, this mango grove is very pleasant and charming. It is eminently suitable for the endeavor in meditation of a young man, etc., etc. If the Lord were to give me permission, I would come and endeavor in this mango grove. If the revered sir, the Lord, give me permission, I would go to that mango grove to endeavor in meditation.' When this was said, the Lord replied to the Venerable Magiya, 'As we are alone, Magiya, wait a while until another monk comes, another bhikkhu comes.' A second time, the Venerable Magiya said to the Lord, 'Revered sir, the Lord has nothing further that should be done and nothing to add to what has been done. But for me, revered sir, there is something further that should be done and something to add to what has been done. If, revered sir, the Lord gives me permission, I would go to that mango grove to endeavor in meditation.' A second time, the Lord replied to the Venerable Magiya, 'As we are alone, Magiya, wait a while until some other bhikkhu comes.' A third time, the Venerable Magiya said to the Lord, 'Revered sir, the Lord has nothing further that should be done. I would go to that mango grove to endeavor in meditation.' 'As you are talking of endeavoring, Magiya, what can I say? Do now, Magiya, what you think it is time to do.'" So that's the opening of the sutta. That's the little kind of drama, the scenario. So there are a few things we can say about this. One is Megia is obviously very keen to go to this mango grove. It's the ideal spot, the ideal place to sit and meditate. Cool, shady, quiet. What more do you want? Yeah. And he feels he can only really get down to meditation under these conditions. If he can just do this, then he'll progress on the path, and he'll progress very quickly. But he has responsibilities, and he can't just go off and leave them. He can't just walk away from them. So he has to get the Buddha to agree to release him from his responsibilities and to let him go to this beautiful mango grove. And the Buddha is very reluctant, and at first sight, it's hard to see why. He says, wait a little, Megia. I'm alone here. This is the sense of what he's saying. I'm alone here until another monk arrives. So that doesn't sound really like a very good reason for holding Megia back from his meditation practice. After all, why shouldn't the Buddha be alone? He should be able to cope, yeah? He's not an old man, he's not sick, so why does he want to hold Megia back? On the face of it seems a bit selfish, yeah? And Megia almost says as much. He says, sir, the exalted one has nothing further to be done, has nothing more to add to what he has done. But for me, yeah, there's yet more to be done. There's more to be added to what I have done. And so he asks for permission, and he asks three times. In other words, Megia is saying, it's all right for you. Yeah, you've attained enlightenment. You can afford to sit about, but I've got a long way to go. I need to get on with it. And the Buddha says, in effect, well, when you put it like that, Megia, what can I say? I can't say that meditation is a bad thing. When you talk of striving for concentration, what can I say? Do what you think it's time for, Megia. So Megia has won the argument. He's got what he wanted. And now he can go off to the mango grove and meditate. So why did the Buddha want him to stay? That's the question. Why did the Buddha want him to stay? Why did the Buddha not want to be alone? Was he afraid of the dark? Now, I suppose it could be that the Buddha didn't think it was a good idea for Megia to go off on his own to meditate. Perhaps he thought Megia wasn't ready yet. For that level of practice. A bit like maybe someone asking me, should I go away and do 2 weeks solitary retreat? And I might say, no, not yet. Try 2 days first. Yeah. So it could have been that, or it could have been that the Buddha needed a sort of secretary. He needed someone to deal with and welcome any people who might come to see him. Come to visit him, because he had lots of visitors. Or he might have just been reminding Megia of his responsibility and the fact that he shouldn't just drop his commitment without having someone to take over from him. It could have been lots of reasons, yeah? However, it would appear that apart from straightforward human companionship, what the Buddha needed was someone to communicate his insights and teachings to, so that they could be disseminated for the welfare of the many, as it were. You could say the Buddha needed the equivalent of a recording device. That's what he needed. This was the function fulfilled by Ananda later on. It wasn't that the Buddha just saw his companions in a functional way. He was a friend. He was a friend to Megia. He was a friend later to Ananda. But part of the reason for having a companion, a large part of the reason it would seem, was that he could pass on his insights. The Buddha was enlightened, which means that he was in a state, you could say, of constant creativity. His mind was constantly creative, and also he was supremely compassionate. This means that he had to give expression to his creativity for the benefit of others. And within an oral tradition, that meant verbally passing on his teaching and passing on his understandings. So if the Buddha was without a companion, in effect, he was rendered ineffective, you could say. He was denied the means of expressing his creativity and his insights. So that was Megia's responsibility. And, well, it seems Megia didn't fully appreciate what was needed of him. He was more concerned, you could say, with his own development, yeah, with his own personal development. He was concerned with what was best for him, and he felt that he knew what was best for him, yeah, i.e. to go and meditate in that very attractive mango grove, yeah. So off he went to the mango grove. Of course, he respectfully saluted the Buddha first. So he might not have, as it were, respected the Buddha's opinion, but he kept up the formalities. Perhaps he wanted the Buddha's approval. In some ways, you could say that the way Maggia saw the Buddha is almost as if he saw the Buddha as standing between him and his spiritual development. And it could be a lesson for us here. Do we always know what's best for us in spiritual terms? Who do we respect as a spiritual guide? Or do we treat them as an authority figure? Because in some ways, that's how Maggia was relating to the Buddha. So perhaps the incident between Maggia and the Buddha could remind us to reflect on receptivity to spiritual guidance, what it means to us. Anyway, let's see what happens next. So this is what the text says. It says, "Then the venerable Maggia rose from his seat, prostrated himself before the Lord, and keeping his right side towards him, went to that mango grove. On entering that mango grove, he sat down at the foot of a certain tree for the rest period during the middle of the day. Now, while the venerable Maggia was staying in that mango grove, there kept occurring to him three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts: sensual thought, malevolent thought, and cruel thought. The venerable Maggia then reflected, 'It is indeed strange, it is indeed remarkable. Although I have gone forth out of fate from home to the homeless life, yet I am overwhelmed by these three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts.' Then the venerable Maggia, on emerging from seclusion in the late afternoon, approached the Lord, prostrated himself, sat down to one side and said, 'Revered sir, while I was staying in that mango grove, there kept occurring to me three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts. And I thought, it is indeed strange. I am overwhelmed by these three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts: sensual thought, malevolent thought, and cruel thought.'" So poor old Maggia has had a bit of a surprise. He's gone into his mango grove, which is the ideal conditions for meditating. Shady, cool, quiet, all the rest of it. And it was not enough to purify his mind, as it were. So he spent his time there in states of distraction rather than the blissful, positive states that he hoped for. Of course, it's to Maggia's credit that he didn't blame the mango grove. Yeah, he didn't blame the mango grove for his mental states. He doesn't say it was too hot or it was too cold or too shady or not shady enough. He just seems a bit puzzled, a bit bemused by the whole thing, that even under such ideal conditions, he still isn't free from hindrances in meditation. It would appear, perhaps, that Maggia is a bit naive. Perhaps he's heard about the importance of having conditions that are conducive to practice, and he's misunderstood that and placed all his faith in conditions. And of course, conditions are of supreme importance, but they're simply the context in which we can make an effort. So this shrine room, for instance, provides good conditions for meditation, at least when the others upstairs are not trampling about in purse. But that's just the beginning. It's just the beginning. When we sit here, we have to make an effort. We have to work with our own mental states and develop positive mental states or keep the positive mental states alive. And also, of course, there are other conditions that need to be put into place in our lives outside the shrine room before we can make progress. We'll come on to that later. So it would seem that Maggia didn't really expect to have to make much effort. And also, he probably had a wrong idea about meditation anyway. He seems to have been a bit overly, as it were, goal-orientated in his approach. He wanted to have a big experience. But meditation is not about big experiences. As Bhante puts it, meditation is a continuous flow of positive mental states. And when we sit to meditate, what's important is the effort we make, not the experience we have. Yeah. So we may have an uncomfortable experience, but if we're making an effort to overcome the hindrances, making an effort to transform unskillful mental states into skillful mental states, then we're having a good meditation. That's a good meditation. We might sit and have a very pleasant experience, but if we're not making an effort to take things further, then it's not a good meditation. It's a pleasant meditation, but not necessarily a good one. A good meditation is one in which we make an effort, either an effort to change our habitual negative mental states or an effort to maintain positive mental states and use those positive mental states for penetrating more deeply into reality. Of course, effort needs to be appropriate, effort needs to be balanced, and so on. We need to know, we need to acknowledge where we're starting from. Yeah? And we need to be patient, and we need to be persistent in our efforts to change. Anyway, Meghia hasn't had a good meditation by any standards, it seems. So he goes back to the Buddha, and he tells him what happened. Now, the Buddha doesn't give him a hard time. He doesn't say, told you so, or whatever. Yeah, he doesn't. We might be tempted to do that, but the Buddha doesn't do that. He sees that the time is ripe for a teaching. Yeah, and so what follows is an important Buddhist teaching, which we need to reflect on and come back to again and again. So here's what the Buddha says. He says, when there are many different translations of this, and I'll be using two different translations, I think, tonight. But anyway, this is one of them. When mind deliverance is as yet immature, Meghia, five things lead to its maturity. What five? Here, Meghia, a bhikkhu has good friends, good associates, good companions. When mind deliverance is as yet immature, Meghia, this is the first thing that leads to its maturity. Furthermore, Meghia, a bhikkhu is virtuous. He lives restraint by the restraint of the Patimokkha, endowed with conduct and resort, seeing danger in the smallest faults. He trains in the training rules he has accepted. When mind deliverance is as yet immature, Meghia, this is the second thing that leads to its maturity. Furthermore, Meghia, a bhikkhu obtains at will, with no trouble or difficulty, talk that is effacing, talk that is a help in opening up the mind and which conduces to complete turning away, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. That is, talk about fewness of wishes, talk about contentment, talk about seclusion, talk about being non-gregarious, talk about putting forth energy, talk about virtue, about concentration, about wisdom, about deliverance, about the knowledge and vision of deliverance. When mind deliverance is as yet immature, Meghia, this is the third thing that leads to its maturity. Furthermore, Meghia, a bhikkhu lives with energy instigated for the abandoning of unwholesome states and the acquiring of wholesome states. He's vigorous, energetic, and persevering with regard to wholesome states. When mind deliverance is as yet immature, Meghia, this is the fourth thing that leads to its maturity. Furthermore, Meghia, a bhikkhu is wise, endowed with the noble one's penetrative understanding of rise and disappearance, leading to the complete ending of suffering. When mind deliverance is as yet immature, Meghia, this is the fifth thing that leads to its maturity. When mind deliverance is as yet immature, Meghia, these five things leads to its maturity. In another translation, it says the heart's release rather than mind's deliverance, which is a much more poetic way. So when the heart's release is immature, these five things leads to its maturity. So this is another Buddhist list, a list of five things. And put quite briefly or succinctly, this list is 1, spiritual friendship, 2, ethics, 3, study and discussion, 4, effort and energy, and 5, insight or wisdom. So that's what it's talking about. Sometimes the language of the Pali Canon almost obscures what's being said. But anyway, that's what they're talking about here. And this is a progressive list, one thing growing out of another. Spiritual friendship leading on to ethics. Ethics to discussion, discussion and study and so on. Discussion and study to effort and energy, and effort and energy to insight and wisdom. Now, I think the first three things on this list are especially important. They're kind of a foundation. So, the first three things, the spiritual friendship, ethics, and discussion or study of the Dharma. So, the real significance of spiritual friendship, the first thing, or the precepts and study of the Dharma, is that they provide objectivity outside of our own subjective experience and our own subjective interpretation of our experience. So we can sometimes give too much credence to our own individual experience, and even more likely we give too much weight or too much credence to our own interpretation of our experience. And this is not something new. This is not just us. This not a new issue. In the Brahmajava Sutta at the beginning of the Digha Nikaya in the Pali Canon, the Buddha outlines 64 wrong views, and a large number of these wrong views are based on the wrong interpretation of meditation experiences. So if we give too much credence to our own interpretation of our own experience, then that interpretation can solidify into a view, even into a philosophy of life. And we may find ourselves contradicting our teachers or our guides or the Buddha. So friendship, the ethical precepts, and the study of the Dharma provide an objective expression of reality, which keeps us anchored in the world of self and other, rather than the world of self. Yeah, it's because we tend to get submerged a bit in the world of self. So Magia knew he was right, and he knew what he needed, and he wanted to do what he wanted to do. Yeah. And it was not, as it turns out, conducive to his spiritual welfare. I've seen this sometimes with people who are wealthy, that some people who are very wealthy, they can do what they want, go where they want, buy what they want, and so on. But sometimes it is not helpful on the spiritual path, that amount of freedom. It's a freedom that's really coveted in our society. It's what's held up as a very high value. You have so much money and whatever, but you can do whatever you like. But actually, it's a freedom that's a kind of a trap, in a way. I think this is the reason why in the Christian tradition some monastics take vows of obedience. It's to work against that natural egotistical tendency to do what we want or get what we want and so on. And of course, sometimes, or perhaps even often, what we need is not what we want, and what we want is not what we need. So that's why we can't rely completely on our own subjective experience and on our own interpretation of our experience. We need friends, we need guides, we need guidelines, we need precepts, we need the challenge of Dharma study and so on. Okay, so let's just look at the Buddha's teaching to Magia, bearing in mind that probably we're much closer to Magiya than we are to the Buddha. Yeah. Or maybe much closer to Magiya than we might like to think. Yeah. So the Buddha says, and this is a different translation, a lovely intimacy, a lovely friendship, a lovely comradeship, when the heart's release is immature, this is the first thing that conduces to its maturity. And the term translated as lovely friendship is kalyana mitrata, or kalyana mitrata in Pali, in Sanskrit, kalyana mitrata. And in his Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his notes to his translation of the Samyutta Nikaya, he tells us that this term kalyana mitrata used to be translated as friend of righteousness, or friend of what is lovely, or friend of the good. But he goes on to say, he says, these renderings all rest on a misunderstanding of the grammatical form of the expression. As an independent substantive, whatever that is, kalyana mitata means a good friend, i.e. a spiritual friend who gives advice, guidance and encouragement. So this is important, because often in Buddhist writings, this term kalyana mitrata was not translated as spiritual friendship, and kalyana mitra was not translated as spiritual friend. It was turned the other way around. It was like friend of the spiritual, or friend of the lovely, or something like that. But Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's one of the probably now possibly the foremost translator of the Pali Canon, says that's wrong. They were wrong in the Treori translation. So it does mean spiritual friend. It does mean spiritual friendship. So it's very clear then that what the Buddha is saying is that the first condition that conduces to the heart's release is spiritual friendship. So the heart is released, you could say, from the prison cage of its own self-obsession by spiritual friendship. The heart is released from the delusion of its own separateness into the freedom of realizing interconnectedness by engaging in spiritual friendship. So engaging in spiritual friendship with those who are more experienced means being receptive and at least reflecting on what they say, which Magiya didn't do initially. And to engage in spiritual friendship with those who are peers or on similar level, those of the same level of experience, means to actively befriend others. Yeah. As Bhante put it again, if you want to have a friend, be a friend. Our tendency is to put ourselves first, to be the center of the universe. I found a little poem here. Well, it's actually quite a long poem, but I'll just quote the first verse or so. It's by an Irish poet called Paul Durkin, and it's called The Center of the Universe. So I couldn't resist putting it in here. He says, pushing my trolley about in the supermarket, I am the center of the universe. Up and down the aisles of beans and juices, I am the center of the universe. It does not matter that I live alone. It does not matter that I am a jilted lover. It does not matter that I am a misfit in my job. I am the center of the universe. But I'm always here if you want me, for I am the center of the universe. I enjoy being the center of the universe. It is not easy being the center of the universe, but I enjoy it. I take pleasure in, I delight in being the center of the universe. So it's quite funny. I like that. It's quite making fun of something that actually is something we do all the time. Yeah. And by engaging in friendship, by giving thought to someone else, by taking interest in them for their own sake, we shift this emphasis slightly. And it's the first steps, you could say, towards loosening our attachment to ourself. Yeah. And the first step towards creating creating spiritual friendship is adopting an attitude and a practice of generosity. I think that's the first step. Adopting this attitude and practice of generosity towards someone else. And the second thing is that we need to listen and take an interest. It's strange sometimes how difficult people find it to take an interest in other people. I suppose it's to do with that being the center of the universe. So listening and taking interest. And then the third thing is as it were, progressively, we move towards a greater openness of communication. Yeah, a willingness to let go of our defences, reveal our fears and our inspirations, our cherished hopes and our dreams or our weaknesses or our foibles, whatever. So gradually we become more open and transparent to each other. Not obviously with everybody, but at least with some people. And there's a great joy in that. There's a great even relief in being able to do that, to be able to communicate fully with another human being. So gradually we become more transparent to each other, and in that kind of experience of naked humanity, we could say, and we can respond with kindness and understanding. And a spiritual friendship, of course, can be, and hopefully is for some of us some of the time, a very intimate personal experience, or it can be more like a teacher-pupil relationship. But of course, in both cases, there will be warmth of feeling between, whether it's between friends who are peers or teacher and pupil. Sangharakshita said that he sees himself as a spiritual friend to all order members. So he's got a warmth of feeling for order members. He's very concerned for our spiritual welfare. But he doesn't have close personal relationships with all order members. So the spiritual friendship is disseminated through his talks and seminars and books and so on. And our receptivity as order members manifests in our willingness to run Buddhist centers and set up communities and try to practice what he's taught us in some way or other. And of course, Sangharakshita is not just a spiritual friend to order members, but to all of those who respond to his teaching, and those who respond to order members are indirectly responding to Sangharakshita. So we talk about, in Sri Ratna, we talk about horizontal and vertical spiritual friendship. Horizontal meaning between peers, as it were, those on the same level, and vertical, the more experienced and the less experienced. Yeah. And in this kind of spiritual friendship, which is more, as it were, vertical, where we're looking up to somebody and whatever, we naturally, when we look up to people, when we respect people and so on, we want to emulate them. That's we want to kind of be like them in some way. And that's how spiritual friendship leads on to the second thing, which is ethics, to ethical behavior and so on, which is the second thing that the Buddha says conduces to the heart's release. So to be in spiritual friendship, spiritual comradeship, in a way necessitates behaving ethically in body, speech and mind, or at least wanting to be ethical or trying to be ethical. And those principles that we have in the five precepts of metta, generosity, contentment, truthfulness and clarity of mind, they're the principles that govern the relationships between people who are practicing Buddhists. And if we're inspired by spiritual friends and are inspired to practice ethics and practice, emulate them in practice and so on, we also probably, invariably want to know what's behind that, as it were. We want to go deeper into it, which is where the Dharma discussion and study and so on comes in. We want to understand what lies behind this ethical behavior. Or we want to understand the bigger picture. So that leads us to the third thing that the Buddha mentions as leading to the heart's release. This is discussion or study, or as the text puts it, talk that is serious and suitable for opening up the heart. For some people, it comes as a great relief to be able to engage in discussion around what is most important to them, what's most meaningful. Because your days can be filled with talking, But so much of it may be functional or frivolous or cynical or whatever. It comes as a great relief, a great satisfaction even, to be able to engage in talk that is serious, talk that touches on what matters, what's meaningful, talk that brings clarity and inspiration. And that's why we have study groups and discussion groups and so on. I know when I was first ordained, which is a number of years ago now, I had a small study group every week. And for me and for the people in that group, it was the highlight of the week, because these were guys who were working in jobs in London, in the city and so on, and they'd come once a week. They were able to talk about what was important to them, what was meaningful to them. And it was fantastic. We didn't have to have a text. We had a text, but often we'd only get as far as one sentence, and that was it. And then we're off talking about whatever it is that interests us. It's a great thing to be able to do. Yeah, it's great that people have this chance to talk and to go deeper into these questions of what is life all about. Of course, it's not just about talk, I suppose, discussion and study and so on. It's also about listening, isn't it? We need to listen, we need to turn things over, we need to take things in, we need to reflect on things, and it's that that makes discussion or study really meaningful. As we listen, as we reflect, as we turn things over in our minds, we start to make them our own. We start to emotionally engage. And when we emotionally engage, then we're moved to act, as it were. Yeah, we're moved to make an effort. And that, of course, is how talk or study or whatever leads on to the fourth thing that conduces to the heart's release, which is energy or effort. You could say we need to make an effort all the time if we're to make spiritual progress. And this basic effort, as I mentioned earlier, that a Buddhist needs to make is an effort to transform unskillful mental states into skillful mental states. And the emphasis here should be on transform. So it's not a matter of denying the existence of negative mental states. It's not a matter of repressing them. It's not a matter of pretending to be positive. It's a matter of change, of transformation. And that means that we have to begin by becoming aware of what mental state we are actually experiencing. We have to introduce, as it were, pauses into our lives, which is where, of course, meditation comes in. In a talk that he gave in 1966 on the topic of nirvana, Bhante puts it like this. He said, "We should not try to escape from ourselves. We should begin by accepting ourselves just as we are. We should try to understand much more deeply than just intellectually why we are what we are. If we are suffering, accept suffering and understand why we are suffering. Or as the case may be, if we are happy, accept the happiness, don't feel guilty about it, and understand why we are happy. This understanding is not something merely intellectual. It is something which has to go very deep down indeed. For some people, this penetration, insight, will come in the course of meditation. Meditation is not just fixing the mind on an object, not just revolving a certain idea in the mind. Meditation involves, among other things, getting down to the bottom of one's own mind and illuminating one's mind from the bottom upwards. In other words, it involves exposing one's motives, the deep-seated causes of one's mental states, the causes of both one's joy and one's sorrow. In this way, in awareness, real growth will take place." So we need to become aware of our mental states and acknowledge them to ourselves, acknowledge rather than justify them, if it's a negative mental state. And I think it is the case that the tendency we have when we do get into a negative mental state is to want to justify it. Our anger can seem to be justified because of what someone else has done or what they've said or whatever. Our greed or our craving is justified because, well, maybe because it just doesn't anyone any harm and we're only enjoying ourselves anyway, or whatever. And doubts or indecisiveness can seem justified. Well, probably they seem justified just because that's what's in our mind sometimes. That's what we're thinking, so it seems justified. The effort we have to make is to move beyond justifying our unskillful mental states to just identifying them and acknowledging their existence. So we don't move into condemning ourselves because, well, that's yet another unskillful mental state. So the extremes are self-justification at all costs on the one hand and self-condemnation on the other. Yeah? The middle way is where we exert our effort in identifying, in acknowledging and transforming our mental states. And if we're already in a positive mental state, then we need to make the effort to maintain that positivity and prevent negative states arising. And in that case, if we're generally in a more positive mental state, what we have to do is pay attention to what we input into our minds, yeah? The input that we expose ourselves to. We need to be mindful of what we read, what we look at, what we engage in. Because all of that has an effect on us, and we need to moderate it in a way that it has a positive effect. So this effort is traditionally known as the four right efforts, the effort to get rid of and prevent unskillful mental states and develop and maintain skillful. And the four efforts apply both within meditation and outside meditation. Actually, the word effort sometimes is a bit difficult for some people. It can sound a bit hard or a bit strained or something like that, a bit like you're pushing. But actually what we're talking about is energy and engagement. Yeah, we're talking about engagement. What we're aiming at is a kind of a free-flowing energy channeled in a positive direction. So we're talking about engaging with our mental states, almost like taking an interest in them, yeah? Engaging, being interested in transforming ourselves. And energy is interesting because energy can be, we can have too much energy or too little energy sometimes. We can have too little energy because somehow it's blocked up within us, it's dammed up inside us. Or we can have too much, we're dissipating it all over the place, where energy is going in every direction. If we don't have enough energy, if it's dammed up within us, if it's blocked up within us, we need to release it somehow. And one of the ways of doing that is through physical activity. Because blocked energy often takes the form of bodily tension or bad posture and things like that. I've certainly experienced that a lot myself, yeah. And a good way to begin to get energy moving is through physical exercise, things like yoga, tai chi, qigong, karate, judo, whatever, going to the gym, dancing. I've certainly found various things like that helpful myself. I've done yoga, I've done tai chi, currently I'm doing qigong. I think as I get older I do less movement. But if you're younger, it's worth considering things like karate or something like that. Certainly in the 1980s, when I first came along to the movement, Bhante used to recommend to younger people, he used to say, do karate or do judo, things like that. Yeah. Anyway, physical exercise can help to free up energy. I've seen dancing help people as well. Dancing really can help to free up energy. Communication can help too. Communication with friends, honest, open communication. Even communication is a bit fiery sometimes. It can help to get energy moving. And of course, in meditation, sometimes energy gets freed up. Sometimes you see people, their bodies just judder or something like that. It happens to me sometimes. Actually, if that's happening a lot, it probably means you need to do something outside of meditation to free up that tension. Yeah. Anyway, those are a few ways to unblock energy. Physical exercise, communication, meditation. Yeah. If energy is being wasted, which I think can be the case frequently and probably is maybe more the issue for a lot of us, that our energy is wasted, especially anxious, restless kinds of people, but it's probably not just anxious and restless kinds of people. What we need to do really is pay more attention to the input, what we're reading, what we're watching on TV or the internet or whatever, what we do, what sort of conversations we engage in, even how we spend our money. Because energy is wasted through unmindful, distracted activity and speech. And energy is wasted through filling our heads with a steady stream or even an avalanche of useless information, which is what's constantly available to us now. So to really stop wasting energy, especially for restless types like myself, we need to just slow down. Yeah? We need to reduce the amount of input and be more selective about what we consume, as it were, what we're doing, what we're saying. Actually, the practice of doing nothing could be very helpful. Take up doing nothing as a practice, but also being bored, just allowing ourselves to sit with being bored that could be a useful. Even when sometimes in meditation people feel there's nothing much happening, it's sort of like a neutral state, but actually it's good to kind of just sit with that, experience it. And see what emerges, because often what we do is we don't like that experience. It's like experience of being a bit empty or something. We don't like it, so we try to get away from it, whether mentally or in other ways, we try to get away from it. So it can be very helpful if we can practice gradually sitting with our own boredom and sitting just doing nothing sometimes. And of course, restlessness and anxiety and so on can look very energetic, but it's kind of neurotic in a way. Whereas virya, which is what this is about, virya is energy in pursuit of the good, which is much more mindful, much more channeled, and therefore more effective. And yes, if we unblock our energies and if we waste less energy, then we would be able to undertake the spiritual life with more zest and enthusiasm and engage in the process of refining our energy. Anyway, that was the fourth point that the Buddha made to Meghiya, that effort and energy are necessary for the heart's release. And the fifth thing which conduces to the heart's release is insight. So when we're able to gather our energies together and then focus on the essential existential questions, we can break through into insight. And here in this sutta, insight refers to insight into impermanence. Insight into impermanence is more than just knowing about impermanence. We know that things come to an end. We know that people die. We know that things get broken and so on. That's not insight. Insight is more even than the experience of impermanence, because we can experience people dying. We can experience the ending of a relationship. We can experience our computer breaking down. But that's not insight. Insight into impermanence goes beyond knowing that all things are impermanent, and it goes beyond our experiences of impermanence. So, because there is still a sense when we experience impermanence at work in our lives, or when we acknowledge the impermanent nature of all things to ourselves, there's still a sense in which we don't fully take it on board. Yeah, there's still an inability to let this knowledge and experience really permeate our lives fully. So we can have the experience that impermanence means that all things come to an end sometime. But it doesn't mean that. All things are impermanent all the time. It's the nature of things to change and keep on changing all the time, always. There's no non-change. There's no non-impermanence. There's only impermanence always. And if we can let this truth really sink into our being to the very depths, then it transforms our whole view of ourselves and the world. It takes us, you could say it takes us outside time. It takes away all fear. Because fear is fear of change often, it's fear of death and so on. But when we know that we're really impermanent, thoroughly impermanent, 100% impermanent, and not just in death, but all the time, every moment, every infinitesimal fraction of a moment, we're a process physically, emotionally, mentally. Nothing stands still. Nothing is fixed. There's nothing to hold on to. There are no moments even. When we know this, when this is constantly before our vision, permeating our vision, then we have a completely different experience of the world. We're liberated from fear, joyful, completely in unity with the flow of energy, the flow of energy that is life. Yeah? And I think this is what's meant in the Heart Sutra when it says, know that the Bodhisattva holding to nothing whatever but dwelling in prajna wisdom is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana. So that's the culmination of the Buddha's teaching to Migya. It begins with Kalyanamitrata, this lovely intimacy, lovely friendship, and everything else flows from that right down to insight and nirvana. And this, you could say this brings us right back here, back to this center, back to this class and its purpose. This lovely intimacy or lovely comradeship that the Buddha talks about is the main reason for coming here on a Tuesday evening. It's the main reason for having a Buddhist center. If we're developing friendship with others based on our common aspiration, then everything else will follow from that. This is what we have to put our energy into. This is what we have to give attention to. Otherwise, even our time at the center could be wasted. So I'm going to leave you with the words of the Buddha as he gives this important teaching on the stages of the path to Migya. He says, it is to be expected of a bhikkhu who has good friends, good associates, good companions, that he will be virtuous, that he will live restrained by the restraint of the Patimokkha, endowed with conduct and resort, that seeing danger in the smallest faults, he will train in the training rules he has accepted. It is to be expected of a bhikkhu who has good friends, that he will obtain at will, with no trouble or difficulty, talk that is effacing, a help in opening up the mind, talk about the knowledge and vision of deliverance. It is to be expected of a bhikkhu who has good friends that he will live with energy instigated, vigorous, energetic, and persevering with regard to wholesome states. It is to be expected of a bhikkhu who has good friends that he will be wise, endowed with the noble one's penetrative understanding of rise and disappearing, leading to the complete ending of suffering. Thank you.